Today on the Nerd Outcast podcast, we spend some time talking about Orson Scott Card's Ender's Game. Excited. This is the first time we've talked about a book on this podcast, so it's going to be really great. We're talking about the book. If you're from the future, we have not watched the movie yet. If this has come out at the time of the movie, which it could because we record really early in the schedule, we haven't seen it. So we're just going to talk about the book. I am your host, and as usual for this podcast, I have brought on some nerd experts to discuss Orson Scott Card's classic sci-fi, I don't know, what would you call this? Coming of age? No.
I would call it a novel.
Novel? Okay. There will be spoilers at the latter half of this podcast, or there might be spoilers early on, so you have been warned. Let me go on and introduce my nerd experts that are here with me today. The first expert to my right is...
Sean Okerberg.
Hello, Sean.
Hello.
Okerberg. Is that pause, like, built into your name?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's Swedish for take a pause here.
All right. That's nice. Yeah. So you've read Ender's Game, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's get a real quick idea. What type of books do you typically read?
I like science fiction. I've read a lot of fantasy. I read Lord of the Rings when I was in junior high and loved it. And all sorts of stuff.
Are you reading The Game of Thrones?
I am. All right. Yeah. Book 5.
Where does Ender's Game rank in your top 10?
Is it in, oh, that's is it way there? Up there, yeah.
It's way up there?
Yeah, it's in my top 10.
Top 5?
Maybe not. What's top 10?
Now I know what the 5 are. We'll talk about the 5.
Ah, yeah.
All right. My next expert with me today is...
Kitten McCreary.
Hello, Kitten.
Hi.
Yay, a new person. And another woman.
One of two. That he'll know ever in his life.
Welcome to the podcast. It's always exciting to have a new person on, because potentially that's at least one new listener.
Ooh.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't think Andrew ever listened. No, he didn't.
No, me either.
Same questions to you, Kitten. What type of books do you typically read? Do you read a lot? Or
I do read a lot. And I read a lot of different kinds of books. I read a lot of science fiction and a lot of sort of like science action, which I feel like is almost its own genre. And other than that, I do a lot of historical fiction. And over the last few years, I've become really addicted to these sort of classic literature monster book mashups.
Okay.
Like Pride and Prejudice and Zombies and things like that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
I've never read those.
They're really good. If you like classic literature, I think it's a good way to get people introduced to that in a format that's a little more palatable for contemporary audiences.
Cool. Awesome. And same question, is Ender's Game in your top 10? Is it in there somewhere?
I think that's a really hard question because the kind of books I like and what's going to be in my top 10 sort of depends on my mood at the time.
Fair enough.
I think it's one of those books that, you know, I read it when I was in grade school and loved it. As an adult, I still love it. So the fact that it holds up to that test, I think, is impressive. But whether or not it's my favorite book at any given time is just going to depend on my mood.
Fair enough. That's probably true of many favorites of any one person at any time. But that's a great analysis to come to.
Thanks.
Yay! And our final expert tonight.
Pete Novice.
Hello, Pete.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
You've been on quite a few times.
What? Several times. Several.
Yeah. No, there's nothing to be ashamed about.
It is a little bit. It is.
Yeah, so what type of... I know you're a big reader. Like, you devour books. Like, you eat them.
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, that is how I consume information, is you biologically.
All right.
Yeah. Good fun.
I know that you read quite a bit. So, is Ender's Game in your top 10, or...?
I couldn't say I've ever made, like, a list like that. It's definitely a book that I would recommend to anybody. Like, if somebody was like, I don't read very much, could you tell me some good books? I'd be like, here, read Ender's Game.
Cool.
Yeah.
And what type of books do you read?
Lots of science fiction and fantasy, a lot of, like, literature. You can't see the quotation marks, but there were quotation marks around that.
I think they could hear the quotation marks, though.
I read for entertainment, because I spend too much time on the bus, so.
Fair enough. All right. And as typical for this podcast, I brought on an outcast. You've heard his sultry tones before.
Aww.
And that outcast for tonight is...
Patrick Sweetman.
Hello, Pat.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
A little sleepy, otherwise good.
All right. Well, hopefully we won't bore you by talking about a...
Me too.
...science fiction book. So... This is the first time we've talked about a book on this podcast. Mm-hmm. Do you... Let's learn a little bit about you. I know you're a nerd.
Yes.
Obviously. Are you a literary nerd? Do you read? Can you read? You can read, right?
I'm functionally illiterate, but okay. You know, when I do read, I like a nice Jackie Collins book, maybe Zane Grey. I like books that are based on movies.
All right.
You know.
Like the novelization of the Star Wars prequels?
I was seeing the novelization of Dude, Where's My Car?
Okay. So. Have you ever read, like, Dune, or...?
I have read the first Dune book. Started the second, but never finished it.
Okay.
I've read some of the classic sci-fi...
Lord of the Rings.
I've actually not read Lord of the Rings, the trilogy, but I have read The Hobbit. But, okay. You know, that's because I only read at a sixth grade level.
Okay. And you have not read Ender's Game?
I have not.
Do you know anything about Ender's Game?
I know my roommate in college had it on the bookshelf for the entire time I lived with him.
Was that my brother?
No.
Okay. That could have been my brother.
Could have been. It was actually Mandrake.
All right. Wow, and you... Wow. I'm surprised that you never read it.
I saw it many times. I said, hey, I wonder if that's good. It's so prevalently placed on the bookshelf.
It is very good.
We're going to destroy the mystery for you.
I know. We can try and avoid the one big spoiler.
I'm about to get my Orson Scott.
No, you can't. It's the point.
All right. We'll talk about the spoiler at the end of the podcast because the spoiler comes at the end of the book.
I'm about to get my Orson Scott cherry popped.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, let's jump into it. Ender's Game was published in 1985, written by Orson Scott Card, who wrote, he's written things.
You haven't read anything else, have you?
He's actually not very much well-known past, like, there's Ender's Game, the Ender's Game series.
And then there's the book signing tour he went on for it.
No, there's another series he's known for, but those two series are really, like, the books.
Okay.
At least all my... crazy internet research pointed to. He's worked.
No, you're crazy. You're crazy. He's got three or four fairly extensive sci-fi series. Others aren't as known as the Ender's books.
Right.
He's also got a bunch of like biblical historical novels.
Yeah. Because
he's like a hardcore Mormon.
Yeah.
Which is a little. It comes across like when you know that about him, you can see it in all his books.
Well, he's also made some very interesting statements about marriage and whatnot, but we won't discuss that. But I don't know if he has a religious background, but he's really delved into areas I was surprised
about.
Well,
he's a hardcore Mormon.
Well, yeah. He's worked in journalism. He's done writing for video games. I want to say he also did some writing for TV, but I'm not entirely... I think that's something I just made up right now.
I think... Didn't he work for theater? Didn't he write plays?
I thought so.
I mean, I know he has like a Shakespeare background. Like, he wrote a couple books set in...
He's like the Mormon Shakespeare.
Yeah, Mormon Shakespeare.
The Mormon Shakespeare.
Oh, it's the Prentice Elvin, the Seventh Son series. Yeah. That's his other big one.
Yeah. Okay.
I know.
So I just had a quick question. Are we just talking about, like, the first book, or are we talking about the whole series?
So we're going to talk primarily about the first book,
okay.
Which I have not read the whole series. I've only read the sequel to Ender's Game, but so far Ender's Game I enjoyed more. I don't know about you guys. Have you all read the whole series?
Yes.
Yes, yeah. But it's been a long time.
Have you read the other series that like take place at the same time within the same universe?
The Shadow series.
Yep. Okay. Yep. We're mainly going to talk about the first book calls that is kind of amazing. And it won a Nebula Award and a Hugo Award and all these other amazing things. And
sweet.
People love it. Published in 1985. I did not read it in 1985. Ironically, I read this book in a science fiction class in high school. And really fell in love with it. Then I read it a couple years later because I thought...
Why is that ironic?
I don't know.
Because you were... It's because you read in high school. Because
I read in high school.
Because it was right after I was a kid in space.
Yeah, I was like 16 or 17, you know, like I really related to Ender. And
who
then...
was six.
Yeah. And then...
that's the spoiler.
Oh, now you know.
And then much later on, I read it when I was out of college, you know, just to see like, oh, I really liked that book. I wonder if I still like it. And yeah, I really still loved it. So this book is definitely probably in my top five, if not in my top three. But yeah, let's talk about Ender's Game. Sean.
Yeah.
Talk about it.
Did you read this in 1985?
I didn't. I read this actually when I was out of college. Yeah.
Okay.
So I was older.
Okay.
I still really liked it. It is a young adult book. Like, yeah. I mean, it definitely has that feel of, if I would have read it when I was a kid, I probably would have liked it even more, but I still thought it was really cool.
You know, before I get any more feelings from you,
yeah,
we probably should give some context to Pat as to what this book is actually about.
Yeah.
So it's called Ender's Game.
What?
It's essentially about Andrew Wiggin, Ender. He goes by Ender.
Okay.
He's a child genius, and at this point...
Like Doogie Howser?
Like Doogie Howser.
Okay.
And feel free to jump in if I leave something out. Earth is at war with this species known as the Formix, which they call the buggers, a derogatory term. I guess kind of...
Because they look like bugs.
Because they look like bugs. Yeah. Think, I guess, Starship Troopers, if you want.
Only better, I hope.
Yes.
Then again, only seen the movie, haven't read the book.
Earth has been through two wars with this species, and they are coming back for a third one. So Earth, I don't remember why, but for some reason decides that children... are the best resource that they have. Mm-hmm. So they start...
But basically because, like, you need so much training.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they're looking for someone to be their next military genius that they're recruiting at, like, age 5 and 6 because that's the only way that somebody can get the background needed to actually lead Earth's fleet when war actually happens.
Yeah, because they're not currently at war. This war happened, right. I think, two different waves of of these guys happened. And so now they're, as you learn through the book, they're at the beginning of the book anyways, they talk about they're waiting for the next wave. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to find the next.
They
like
want
to
be ready.
They want to be ready with the next great genius to do that.
So they essentially bring Ender... to the school and start training him because they recognize that he might be a military genius with all these other children. And that's kind of the stage for the book. I don't want to spoil anything just yet. So that's the context of the book.
But in 10 minutes.
Chapter 2.
But in chapter 2. So yeah, Sean.
Yeah.
Feelings on this book.
Happy, sad, melancholy, confused, laughter.
Got it.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's good. I mean, it's kids in space. It's very different than the rest of the series. The rest of the series is him older. Like, it jumps to him being older. And the rest of the series is more about aliens and whatnot. But this is just about, like, him and him going through this and him being a kid thrust into the position of trying to learn how to, you know, be a military genius. And a big section of it is... his teachers are isolating him, basically. They're, you know, they're trying to turn all the other kids against him, basically.
He's already actually kind of been isolated his whole life because he is the third of three children, which is illegal. The world has mandated that you can only... It's two children, right?
They've mandated that you can only have two children, and in order to have a third child, you have to have special permissions from the government. And only because his parents were so overwhelmingly intelligent and both of his older siblings were, was the family allowed to have a third child because they noticed the genetic predisposition that he could potentially be the one to save the universe.
Are you sure this was written by a Mormon?
What? An oppressed family? Is not allowed to have as many kids as they want?
And so they have to start going away to other planets to do this?
Kitten, let me jump over to you. When did you read this?
I actually probably read this in 1985, because I'm older than all of you put together.
I wasn't going to bring
all of us put together.
So I did read this originally when I was in grade school. I was raised by nerds, so... you know, subscriptions to science fiction magazines and all that were just sort of in the house. So this, you know, was a good read for me. And I felt like it was very age appropriate, you know, because I was about the same age as you see Ender, you know, get about midpoint later in the book. So it was very easy for me to relate to. And it's a book that's written in such a way that, you know, it's not overwhelmingly technical, even though it's set in space, even though it is about military maneuvers and, you know, that sort of development, it's still very much a story of these children. I mean, not just Ender, but also both of his siblings and how they're dealing with this world that they're thrust into. And not only is it about them dealing with the world they're thrust into, it's about them dealing with the fact that there are hints that they were genetically engineered to be geniuses. And so they sort of take this idea of like, well, the adults who we don't trust wanted to force us to be these certain things. And so now we're going to take these traits and completely run with them and far exceed the expectations that were placed upon us and do things that these adults never anticipated. And I think in a lot of ways, that's the sort of thing that's a very positive message for a child is, you know, look at what you've been given, look at what the expectations are of you, and do better.
Cool. Wow. Very nice.
Thanks.
I can top it. I can top it.
All right, Pete, let's jump over to you real quick. Did you read this? Did you read this in 1985?
Probably not 1985, but okay. Pretty shortly thereafter. I think I was in junior high or high school, and I think my mom brought it home from the library. Oh. Like for herself to read, and I just grabbed it and went through it in about 2 days.
Okay.
I think the first time I had encountered a book that I was never bored with the book. So you could just read for hours and hours and hours. Mm-hmm. And like I got to the end of the book finally, and I remember I was physically exhausted by just like that. It was great. It was great.
Yes, this was like, very much a hiding under the covers with the flashlight, even like, yeah. Turn off the light. Go to sleep. No, I have to keep reading. Yeah.
I think the thing I really liked about it was that, especially as a kid, you're reading this book and you forget that it's a book about children because mm-hmm. they're not written as helpless people. They're not written as people who like rely on anyone else to do anything for them. Like they've been given this responsibility and put in a situation where they're completely self-reliant and they have to make their own decisions. They have to just get things done.
Do you feel, just to jump on that, do you yep. feel that Orson Scott Card, you said that they don't feel like they're written like children. Do you feel that they are even written as children? Like, is he even making
like, is that credible? Or
I don't know. I don't know what I'm trying to ask.
I mean, I think the point of the book is that, like, in general, people get to be adults, mm-hmm. and they forget that kids have these, like, complicated webs of social divisions and conspiracies and like plots against each other, that there's this real struggle for like who's the leader, who's the outcast. Kids are really vicious, and so often it's because there are adults around to like rein in what kids are going to do to each other. Like in this book, it's really like you basically take a boot camp situation, but you put a bunch of 6 to 10 year olds in it. Mm-hmm. You know, how do they react under those kind of pressures and training and that push to succeed and to be the best? And
okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the adults in it are not, they're celebrating their more savagery.
You right. Know, they provoke that.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
All right. You know, it's funny, like the military situation that you mentioned, this is on the Marine Corps reading list. I don't know if it's required reading for the Marine Corps, but I know it is on there suggested, hey, before you come to boot camp, please read this. And I just pulled off some quotes about it, specifically for the Marine Corps. They say it provides useful allegories to explain why militaries do what they do in a particularly effective shorthand way, and that they are lessons in training, methodology, leadership, and ethics. I want to throw out a few. Well, we'll come to the reviews later. I don't want to read the reviews yet. So I'm going to start with what I usually end podcasts with, but what is it about this
book?
Goodbye. Goodbye. What is it about this book? Like, why do we like this book? And we can go into any specific details at this point, except for the big one at the end of the book.
I feel like it holds up. Like, as you're reading it, it's this cool adventure story of this kid dealing with a situation. But even like thinking about this today and thinking about like, why is this such a great book? Because by the end of the book, Ender has become such a great leader in battle because he's able to understand his enemy. But by that point, he identifies so much with the enemy that he no longer feels like a part of his own people mm-hmm. and actually becomes an outcast, like can never go back to Earth. And it's these ideas of like, who is alien? Who is dangerous to me? How far does the circle of who I need to protect extend? Am I responsible even for the well-being of my enemies? You know, and there's a lot in there about how far do you go to protect yourself and to protect people around you? Is any degree of brutality acceptable in a life and death situation?
Okay. Something you mentioned, Kitten, that I kind of want to address and throw over to Pat. early on in the book, like, he gets taken and trained at this, they call it battle school, and then if you do well enough in battle school, you get promoted to command school. Battle school is essentially, like, really awesome laser tag, where you're, like, working within your squad to, like, do all these different squad-based tactics and missions. And then in command school, he gets put in charge of, like, squadrons.
Right.
Is that correct? Squadrons.
Right, he's put into a module that's basically the equivalent of, like, okay, so now instead of being the physical body that's moving through space and being the ship, you're commanding the ship and giving orders to the other ships around
you.
Right.
It's like a battle simulator.
Yeah. One thing you mentioned, Kitten, and this is something that's always jumped out to me about this book, and sometimes it bothers me, and sometimes I'm completely okay with it. For being a science fiction book, like, the technology of the world is never really laid out for you. Like, Ender is doing all these military tactics, but you really don't know, like, what is his spacecraft actually capable of? What are his weapons actually capable of? It's kept very generalized.
Right. And that's one of those things that I appreciate about it. I think that's one of the reasons why it holds up to time. Because there's so many things that we read now or movies that came out years ago that you look at the technology and reality has caught up to that technology. So there's no mystery, there's no wonder, there's no fiction to that science fiction anymore. Because Orson Scott Card left all of this very vague and very open, it's one of those things that remains timeless because it doesn't have that fixed, well, we had this technology, so the next logical step would be this, so it's written for that future. And so I think that's something that really lends to the book lasting longer. And I also feel like it's a book that, yeah, it's a book about space travel, it's a book about fighting aliens, but in a lot of ways I feel like it's less a science fiction book in that aspect because it's not as much about the science as it is about telling these people's stories, about telling Ender's story, about telling the story of, you know, the other two children, about getting those touches into, like, the military personas and doing all of that. And so the actual science, the technology behind it, isn't as important in telling that story.
Well, in a lot of the classic sci-fi novels, the science is really not explored. The science is just the setting. You know, like Dune, you don't, you know, aside from spice to propel yourself across the universe, they don't really get into much of technology. Even going back to, like, Frankenstein, which was, like, kind of the first science fiction book, you never really get into the details about how the creature is made. You know, it's, again, and it does keep it timeless because,
right,
you know, something, if they get too specific, it's lost. But, like, Philip K. Dick, all of his stuff was just super vague on the way it happened. And it just...
Yeah, it's a character piece. I mean, it's really going into the story. And I think I read one quote that is from Orson Scott Card, is the movie, it's a book that can't really be filmed because...
Yeah, I've got that quote right here.
Yeah, it takes place inside the mind. So much of it is inside the mind of
Ender.
Which totally makes sense, and I can see that, and that's why I'm a little worried about the movie. But it's really about this kid in this incredible situation, and it just happens to be in a science fiction world because I don't know why, but it works.
Well, because I feel like, you know, their tools for training are like, well, let's start off with giving him a video game.
Yeah.
And then let's start off with, you know, by the next step, giving him games of laser tag, and then let's give him, like, a larger battle simulated video game. So that, I think, is where, you know, sort of your science fiction comes into it, is like, okay, let's take these things and make them palatable to a child to do, like, these, you know, larger, more military based things that should theoretically be outside of their scope. Because you don't generally look at children and think, yes, that's the child that's going to be, you know, a brilliant military tactician. But it's still very easy for an adult to look at a child and be like, yeah, that's a kid who's going to do great with some video games.
Yeah.
Well, and, like, they're being trained to make strategic decisions, not to, like, fight hand to hand. You know?
But there
and,
is
like,
some of
although
that.
There is.
They do get taught
in their training. But, like, the important thing, the thing they're really looking for and the thing they really push for Ender is, like, the big picture of the battle.
Right.
Because they want somebody who's going to think of a solution that nobody ever thought of before.
So let's, if nobody minds, let's jump into the specific characters. Mainly the three that we've kind of been dancing around. Ender, his older brother Peter, and his older sister Valentine. Oh man, who do you guys want to talk about first?
I want to talk about Peter.
You want to talk about Peter? All right, Peter is the older brother. He's the firstborn.
He was the first benchmark.
Yes.
And he's very intelligent.
Yeah. Right. Like, he is a genius in his own right.
And he's like, how old is he? Do we know how old he is?
I think he's like 10 at the beginning of the book.
Yeah, he is 4 years older than Ender, and Valentine is 2.
Okay.
Years older.
So Peter did not get accepted to battle school because he's too vicious.
It's really vicious.
There's a scene in the book in which he has, like, skinned a squirrel alive and staked it to the ground just to watch how long it's going to take to die.
Yeah.
Like, that scene stuck with me through my entire life.
He's a sociopath, yeah.
And he's so, so bitter at the fact that he was passed over. He tries to recruit his sister to be part of his little cabal of, like... And, like, as kids, like, he plots to take over the world. Mm-hmm.
As you do.
And he eventually does. Because he's a genius. But yeah, I had a conversation a while ago about how all good characters in literature named Peter, you know, like, there are no bad Peters in literature. And then I was like, well, except Peter Wiggin.
Peter Wiggin's pretty awful. Well, it's really strange because, I mean, the book essentially has two plot lines. It has the plot line of Ender, but then they cut back to Earth as to what Peter and Valentine are doing. And they have this whole... It's definitely like a B plot, but it's really important for its effect on the world. It's really, really strange. Which it's probably not going to be in the movie at all. I really don't think it's
going to be. Yeah, I'm worried about that too. Well, you're right. It is very important.
It is important. I don't think you can have that. I mean, because so much of what they do is justifying the entirety of the end of the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, Ender is fighting the war, and they are fighting for what happens after the war.
Right. They're writing political philosophy online.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're kids, and they pose as these brilliant writers, and they start getting this huge presence online and start getting really well-respected, and this leads to them, you know, finally Peter saying, I'm just a kid, and I'm actually Ender's brother. But anyways, it's how they become powerful while still being children.
Yeah. And they're doing this at the ages of 10 and 12.
Yeah.
Well, then you have Valentine, his sister. So she's pretty much like the opposite of Peter, if I remember this correctly. It's been a while since I've read the book.
Right.
She's really smart, of course.
Yeah. With Valentine, she, like all of the Wiggin children, she is exceptionally intelligent, but she had no sense of aggression and no sense of violence. And that's why she did not get moved forward for battle school. And so, you know, again, that's why the family was allowed to have a third child, because they figured the third child would be the balance between the other two.
If Goldilocks taught us anything.
Yes, the third one's just right. So she's passed over for that because she's not nearly violent enough. And one of the things that becomes interesting about that in her story arc is that when Peter and Valentine are starting to write all of their political treatise on everything that's going on and the personas that they take, she takes the one that is far more violent and far more revolutionary. Mm-hmm. Because that way, you know, the children are more challenged and it's not something that comes out distinctly as them to be picked out in doing this.
Does Peter take like the more...
He takes the more rational, like the peaceful mediator role. And then she takes the one that's more violent and, you know, proposing war and change. And it's all a complete setup. So once both of these parties, you know, these fictional parties that they've created have massive followings, they're able to come together and propose this, you know, compromise between the two sides. Yeah. And everybody else in the world and all of the other political leaders are like, yay, let's do that. And that was their setup from the very beginning. Yeah. But it's also their declarations, like the things they do to create peace on Earth, on the planet, that makes it to where Ender can never go home after the space war.
Because right, like, at the very beginning, not at the beginning of the book, but you learn the history of Earth is there's huge wars going on, three major powers that are basically destroying each other. Okay. When the aliens come in, the Earth unites. Mm-hmm. And so Peter and Valentine have kind of looked ahead, and they realize that once this threat ends, the world is going to go back to war. And so they're kind of setting up the stage to
And it should be noted that they looked ahead because they already, like, Peter already started hacking into systems and tracking government and military movements and shipments of supplies and things like that, and was able to predict, oh yeah, once, you know, the war with the buggers is handled, then, you know, this political faction is gonna launch, you know, it's gonna start war again on Earth. So, you know, even like, he started, like, from the very beginning being able to predict that was going to happen, even when other political powers and government structures didn't see it.
Then you have Ender, who is, like, a balance of the two. And he's really... I remember Ender being kind of really like, oh, why is this happening to me? Oh, man, I just want to, like, be a kid. I just can't be a kid. But then, like, you were just talking about this the other day, Sean. Like, the thing that gets him in the battle school, he was going to be passed over, and then a kid picks a fight with him. Is it in the bathroom, or is it just in the school?
No, that's
just
later.
There's a bully at school.
And then, so what happens with this bully?
Well, he ends up fighting this bully, finally, and he ends up provoking him so that it's a one-on-one, because his whole, you know, group of friends is going to beat him up. And he beats him up so badly that he ends up killing him. He doesn't know it. Like, he knows he hurts him. But he talks about this philosophy of, you have to fight all of your battles right now. Like, you have to be so severe that you win all your future battles. In other words, that they will never come back to attack you because you've showed such superiority.
Do they describe the fight? I don't remember. I remember the bathroom fight. I don't remember how does he beat the bully? Do you guys remember?
Kicks him in the head.
He kicks him in the face.
Well, he knocks him down and then just keeps kicking him until they pull him off him.
Right. Okay. And he doesn't realize at that point that he's killed the kid. Like they pull him out of school and he's gone. Yeah. And that's when, like, that philosophy of you have to hurt him so bad that he will never come back to hurt you is what gets him in the school. Because I think they're at that point they're thinking he's not quite strong enough to do that. And that's
right. Yeah, they wanted to have these moments where they're like, well, maybe he's like Valentine and he's just too passive and not aggressive enough. But they still gave him this moment to fight. But then they wanted to wait and see what his reasoning was behind it, because they didn't want him to be as violent as Peter. They didn't want him to take pleasure beating the ever-living crap out of this other child.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was doing it out of a sense of pure survival is what made them go, oh, good, he's violent for all the right reasons.
Well, I think that's why they withhold telling him, like, oh, you killed that kid.
Oh, yeah,
because
they
know that would take the fight out of him.
Yeah, they never tell him.
Because
he's
also way too empathetic and compassionate.
Which is another big reason why he succeeds, is because he creates this army around him of
people, like, people
that
who really love him and
love
each other.
Him and, and it's, I mean, there's definitely the violence of the book, but there's also that a little bit of that
friends can take on anything. The two fights are really, I remember just like reading them, like, oh man,
that,
like,
bathroom
far
fight.
More brutal than anything he does in any of the laser tag training or any of the squadron training. It's just like, oh man. So those are the three main characters. Pat, do you have any questions so far?
No, so far.
Okay, so
I feel like we should say he kills the kid in the bathroom too.
He kills him. He doesn't know it.
It happens again.
It's another one of those guys who's been like pushing him and he's like, I have to control how this confrontation will happen.
And this kid comes and picks a fight with him in the bathroom, right?
Yeah,
is that what happens?
They follow him. A whole crowd follow him into the bathroom, and you know, and there is actually like a scene where, you know, Ender's explaining to him, he's like, okay, yeah, there's going to be great pride in you doing this. You're a foot and a half taller than me. You're 3 or 4 years older than me. You have a whole crowd with you. I'm wet, naked, and alone.
And then, I mean, that's one thing I love about that scene is his strategy immediately kicks in. Is he's like, well, I'm smaller and I'm wet, so I'm hard to hold on to. The floor is wet, so I can knock him down really easily. You know, like, he just like sees the strategy.
But he still went into it. Like, he manages to get the child, you know, the other child, to attack him by himself.
Yeah.
By offending his sense of pride.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing that saved him, because otherwise, if he hadn't taken those moments beforehand, then the whole crowd of children would have torn him apart.
Yeah. So essentially, that's kind of where the book, like, Ender is presented with scenario after scenario in the training, where he has to just deal with different things, and he gets trained by Hiram Graff is the trainer of the battle school. He gets trained by a war hero later on called Mazer Rackham, who won the second war.
Yes.
I think is how it goes, at the command school. And it's really strange, because as you're reading the book, I mean, it's becoming, like, really clear, like, wow, Ender's really good. But mm-hmm. there's also, like, this desperation on the side of the adults of, like, wow, they're really pinning their hopes on him. Like, I mean, he's not even out of command school yet, mm-hmm. and they're really pinning their hopes on him.
He's not even out of puberty yet.
He's not even out of puberty yet, and they're really pinning their hopes on him. Yeah, do you guys want to chat about anything else before we go any further?
Well, okay, so Ender gets taken away from his parents at age 6.
Yeah.
They cease to exist in the world of the book. Like, they're not dead, but they're completely irrelevant from that moment on. He sort of has, like, these foster parents. Colonel Graf and Mazer Rackham, in the sense of, like, they're these male authority figures who oversee his training, who will occasionally talk to him as a human being, but they're also very clearly manipulating him.
Played by Harrison Ford in the movie.
The man.
Yeah.
But then on the female side, his sister Valentine is very much a foster mother to him, and she gets brought back in, actually, by Graf when Ender has a complete breakdown. A
couple times.
Yeah. And, like, she hates the fact that she's being used for this. But they bring her in, they're like, we need him, and we need you to use your relationship with him to get him back into training. And she does it.
Yep.
But there's also Petra, who is his friend at battle school, but also later one of his sort of subordinate
generals or
squadron members. Yeah.
One of his
and she's very much that sort of, like, preteen, not quite girlfriend, sort of mother. You know, she's a few years older than him, kind of takes care of him. Definitely his first crush kind of thing.
Does he have a crush on her? I don't remember that.
It's never overt, but there's definitely, like,
something.
There's that kid sense there of, like, I don't really know what relationships are yet.
I don't know. I personally didn't get that out of it. I mean, I don't feel like his relationship with Petra was that different from his relationship with Alam.
Maybe, but I feel like there was a...
I just feel like it was more of a sibling thing. I think she became the Valentine substitute.
Maybe I'm reading in what the relationship I wish I had with Petra as a kid. She's awesome.
She was. But no, it's like when Ender first goes to battle school, he has that first, you know, moment of Alam coming to him. Right. And, you know, being a friend to him and sharing, you know, this moment of closeness. And then when he gets transferred from the battalion he's gotten to know and what he's gotten to work with and sent off to do his own thing, Petra is the next person who basically does that exact same thing. She shows him that same kindness and the whole, I'm going to teach you the things that you don't know.
Right.
And I think that's sort of what Valentine did for him when, you know, he was still at home in that whole, like, there's not a whole lot I can do for you to protect you from this or from that, but I can teach you some of the things that you're going to need to protect yourself. And yeah. She was also the one who came to him to give him the warnings that, you know, he was going to get jumped in the bathroom and beaten to death.
Yeah.
So.
Right. And I think that's as much of parents as Ender ever gets.
Right.
Is the people who are not hostile to him.
He's pretty alone.
Yeah.
He's pretty
yeah.
freaking
well,
alone.
I think that's a major theme of it, is that they want him to be that way. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't, you know, the kid mentality is, no matter what happens, mom and dad are going to make it better. And I can always say, hey, help, and something will happen to stop danger. And they want to take that away from him right away. They want to make sure that he knows that he has nobody, that nobody will come to his rescue, and he has to do it himself.
I feel that the adults also recognize that Ender is at his best when he is backed into a corner by himself. Because I feel they don't do this isolation technique with the other kids.
They don't, like, because they think that he's
the other kids
don't
have
why they
potential.
Do it.
I notice you've got another name written down over there.
Bean, who is like... He's, like, the tiniest child in the universe.
There's something we should tell you about Bean. He's kind of, like, everybody loves Bean. Nobody doesn't love Bean. He's such a popular character that Orson Scott Card wrote a whole series about Bean. And, in fact, he wrote, what's the, Ender's Shadow, essentially Ender's Game from this other character's point of view, which is, I really want to read it.
Yeah.
It's good.
But, yeah, like, he's this tiny kid. In the original book, in Ender's Game, he's just a really tiny kid.
Yeah.
He's a bean. But he's also brilliant. Mm-hmm. Comes up with bizarre strategies. He's one of the people that Ender relies on completely. But he's another one of those characters that, like, if Ender wasn't there, he probably would have been the guy.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
so they're like every other character in this battle school has all they all have like the same kind of balance of aggression and compassion. They're all brilliant leaders, and it just happens that they're all overshadowed by this one person
who doesn't necessarily want to
overshadow
them. So we're at 40 minutes. If you do not wish to have the end of the book spoiled for you, stop listening, go read it, and then come back. Pat, if you don't want
to... I'll see you in 20 minutes.
So you have been warned. So like I was saying earlier, all the adults really pin their hopes on Ender. And as you get...
I'm starting to as well.
Yeah. as you get to the end of the book, he gets presented with challenge after challenge, ridiculous odds, and he gets put into a final battle simulator.
So this is all still training. The war hasn't happened.
Right.
This is all still training. And he does this last mission. God, how does the last mission play out? Like,
so he's been going through this series of increasingly stressful simulator missions with all of his fellow students working under him as his lieutenants and all that. They're commanding these fleets of ships, and like every new simulation, they've got like less and less technologically advanced ships, and they're going up against more and more well-defended planets and stations and things like that. And like so things are constantly ramping up. Final mission...
The Death Star.
there's a planet that is defended by this utterly unstoppable fleet.
Mm-hmm. They're outnumbered like 1,000 to 1.
Right. Yeah. And the Earth fleets, their ships have this weapon with which will basically be like a chain reaction of nuclear fission, and it will disintegrate anything, but it has to be things that are close enough together. So all the enemy fleets are spread out, so they can't use this weapon against them. And Ender decides that the only way he can win this battle... I'm getting all teary-eyed now.
I'm with you, buddy.
He sends most of his fleet to engage the enemy fleet, and as soon as an opening shows up, he sends one ship with this weapon down to the planet and detonates this weapon and disintegrates the entire planet and then, like, everything in space. So, like, both sides' fleets are destroyed.
He's erasing everything. And he thinks that he has lost... the mission. He's like, well, that's the best I could do.
I just cheated it just to, so you guys will leave me alone. You're going to kick me out of school now and I can go home.
Because there's been a couple of parallels. There was like the thing when he was still in battle school of the things I had to do of like, you know, just meet these corners and then get someone out. Mm-hmm. And so with this simulation, he's looking at it very much in the same way of like, well, yeah, if I destroy the planet, it in theory will, you know, destroy this entire species. Because the whole concept is like, you're being sent to the bugger planet. They have a queen. When the queen is dead, they're all dead. And so he goes in, he's like, so now he's having to like deal with that whole thing of like, okay, I'm probably not supposed to commit genocide. Mm-hmm. But in looking at the pure numbers, he decides that that's absolutely the only way to get out of the situation.
So he does this. And he thinks he's going to get kicked out, and all the generals like start applauding and celebrating, and he's like, wow, that's a very strange reaction. Why are they doing that? And then he learns like he was actually in charge.
It was never a simulation.
And he has committed genocide. Yeah. Then he has a nervous breakdown.
And he ordered that one guy to like fly down.
I mean,
and he sacrifices
his fleets. Like he's sacrificing real lives and he doesn't know it. Something that's interesting that I read is Orson Scott Card for the movie is putting this right at the top. I don't know how. But the big reveal is going to be at the top where, the audience knows he's actually controlling the real military. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the book, you don't find out till at the end.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a 30-year-old book.
Yeah.
You know, the secret's out.
You kind of see it coming as you read the book, like,
right.
just with the expectations of the government. And, like, more generals come and start watching him. And it's like, wow, this is a really
big
deal.
As an audience, you feel it. But, like, he is a character.
Right. Yeah. And you don't... Pretty much the one and only time. You have two times where Ender actually has conversations with the adults. Mm-hmm. The first one is when he's like just getting out of battle school and is deciding that he's not going to go to command school. And that's when they bring Valentine in the first time to deal with him.
Yeah.
But then there's the transport from battles, from Earth going to command school. And it's then that he actually has this long, drawn-out conversation with Graf. And Graf starts explaining, we found this technology that the buggers have in which they're able to communicate instantaneously by thought. And then the next conversation he has with an adult is with Mazur. And Mazur's like, that's when we learn purely by accident that if you kill the queen, they're all dead. So yeah, those are the two points. It's like, yes, the only time he's ever going to have a conversation with an adult mm-hmm. are going to be these things that are these two pieces of technology that will lead up to him winning this final simulation. Oh, right. Okay, yeah, because it was never a simulation because we took their technology.
So for I want to get my expert's reactions here. So reading the book, I didn't have this spoiled for me. I knew something happened at the end that like you didn't expect to happen. And as I read further into the book, you know, I got that sneaking suspicion like this is maybe not a simulation. And then when you get to that final battle, for me, I was like, I wasn't surprised that it was an actual battle or the actual war that he was controlling, but I was so desperately hoping that they weren't doing that to him, but they did. And then he does commit genocide and it's like, no. I loved it. Like, I mean, that blew me out of the water when I read that. Mm-hmm. I thought that was great. It was a twist, but it's a twist you see coming.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I like the fact that throughout the course of these books, he has to make decisions without being able to control the consequences. You know, he kills two kids along the way. He exhausts members of his squad to the point where they have nervous breakdowns. And like, if he was sane and knew the consequences of his actions in the simulator, he never would have done it. But he is able to make like the best strategic decision because he's completely disconnected from the consequences.
They say something like that. We took the morality out of it for you, mm-hmm. right? You know, so I think
they tell him like, no, you shouldn't feel guilty because you didn't decide to do this. Mm-hmm. We just decided to put you in this situation where you could do it.
He feels guilty, surprising enough.
Still, yeah.
Right.
Kitten, what about you?
It was a little bit of a surprise, but you know, it wasn't, I saw it coming, but it wasn't one of those things that when it finally did happen, I was like, oh man. It's, you know, I felt like it was built up too nicely. Mm-hmm. And I might be one of those weird people in the fact that I don't even feel like that's the twist.
Ooh.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
We'll talk about that.
I'm curious. That's the twist.
Now I'm curious. Is there a spoiler? Should I not listen to the next 10 minutes?
Did you finish reading the book?
No, I stopped after that. I was just so heartbroken.
Like, done. But I also think that whole thing of like, you know, them, you know, putting him into the simulation and, you know, taking away the consequences of things. I also feel like that's one of the important pieces of why it was children that they were using for this. Because children, I think, don't have the same concept of permanence and consequences that adults do. And so I think it was very important to start, you know, getting these children very early on and getting them to do these like horrible, violent things. Because an adult generally isn't going to kick someone to death purely with the idea of, I just had to do it so they'd never beat me up again. Right. I mean, you know, there are more limits because an adult's going to have that whole, I'm going to go to jail, this is going to happen, right. That's going to happen. And because kids don't have that, that's why they had to have children to fight the war.
Sean, what'd you think about the genocide?
Yeah, it was cool. I don't remember being all
it
that
was
surprised.
Cool.
It was cool. Genocide's awesome.
I know, it's cool for you, buddy.
Yeah. Gotta do what you gotta do. Humans forever! I don't remember being super surprised, but okay.
Did you see it coming? Or?
Yeah, it's kind of like, at that point, you're near the end of the book, and you know that
this is... Well, he's gotta go fight the war.
It's not gonna be like the last page, and then he wins the war.
Yeah.
No, it's...
there was much rejoicing.
Yeah.
Hooray!
Yeah. And, so it was... Yeah, not surprising. It's not surprising that it just totally floored him and made him, you know.
And that's drunken, alcoholic, gambling. No.
And it's, you know, it's interesting because it's, you know, it goes out of its way to make a very morally pure good guy. You know what I mean?
It really influences his character for the rest of the series, as it should.
Absolutely. Wow.
So what do you two think? Please skip ahead. Stop listening if you don't want to know the second twist. All right,
so the second twist. Okay, so in the beginning of the book, one of the things that Ender is doing is playing this video game.
Oh, yes.
With this giant. Yeah. And his whole thing is like he goes in and he finally like eventually like kills the giant in this world and gets through to the end of the world. And then he gets from the end of the world to another place.
Which is also the origin of sentient AI in this universe. Which
it is. Because even like the commanders are like, we don't know what the computer's doing. it's getting information from we don't know where. So that's an interesting thing to see, that like these people who are supposedly controlling so much of this entire universe don't have control. But so he defeats the giant, and it ends up creating this whole other like universe and landscape, and grasses grow up, and the giant's, you know, skeleton becomes like part of this landscape.
Yeah, like the game keeps responding to Ender's.
Right. Well, so but time progresses within this time within the game.
Yeah.
So at the end of the book, towards the end of the book, of course, now Ender cannot go back to Earth. It's been set up where he's like, no, he just can't ever go back and be like controlled by people or whatever else. So he and Valentine then go off to the bugger's homeworld,
which he nuked.
Right, which he nuked, has destroyed everything. And at first he didn't want to go, but there was nowhere else for him to go.
Well, I think he goes to one of their bases. Like the world, their homeworld is gone. Like it does not exist anymore.
Yeah. Or is it just like in shambles?
It's basically like restored to an elemental state.
Right.
Yeah. Humans
are going to go colonize all of the bugger planets.
Right. We're great.
Because they're all dead now.
Right. And
Human forever!
Right. And this is one of those things that now there's going to be like, you know, freedom of procreation and people can have more than two children and
Mormons!
All of that. Go Mormons! So he goes to the bugger planet and he's there as the governor, and they have the first colony set up. And then they're like, hey, we're going to bring more people, find a place for them to set up a second colony that's going to be close enough to you guys that you'll have each other's protection, but not so close that you're completely integrated and they can be autonomous. So he goes out to explore. And he finds this landscape, and he recognizes that the landscape is the giant. And he then goes through and follows this thing through to a point in the game that he had never been able to get past. And as he's going through this thing in the game, he finds an egg, which is the fertilized egg of one of the hive queens for the buggers. Because in the whole thing of going through these simulations, and the fact that it was actually the real war, the fact that they were using the bugger technology to do this, not only was he able to see their tactics and start fighting the way they fight, they were able to see into his head. Uh-huh. So they built the landscape so he would recognize it and come and find the queen.
He finds this this egg. This is the last bugger. Mm-hmm. This is the last of their race. And does she communicate with him telepathically?
Yes.
Is that what happens?
Well, she starts off first with just like raw emotions of...
Like he's holding the egg and he...
Right. He's holding the egg and he's like, well, what happened? And there had already been discussions previously of the, you know, well, why are we at war with the buggers? Mm-hmm. And it basically came down to the fact that they were at war because they couldn't communicate. Humans relied on reading and writing and verbal communication. The buggers were purely instantaneous thought.
Yeah.
And the buggers never wanted to kill the humans. And so you have that instant bond where the queen, who has all of the feelings and thoughts and everything else of her entire species over time, he's like, well, what happened? And she's able to convey to him absolutely all of the exact things that he felt when he found that he had destroyed their people.
Yeah.
And so from that, they are now bonded in this sense of agony. He gets to feel a little better because he hasn't actually committed complete genocide. Mm-hmm. And he can hopefully
just
help her find...
She like asks him to take the egg and like take it to a safe place.
Like someday when there's a world that's safe for us.
Yeah. That's what I think is the twist, is that it's not all lost.
So I want to step back and... Mm-hmm. So what happens... You guys had touched on this earlier with Peter and Valentine's thing on Earth.
Sure.
And also you referenced...
They win.
Ender not being able to return to Earth. I mean, but, you know, but why and what were the consequences? Right. How did that play out?
Well, there's one thing you should know. Like, when space travel in this world... Can someone explain space travel? Because that really influences,
they can travel near speed of light.
Right. So as, like...
But not, like, at warp or anything.
So as in, like, it takes Ender, like, 2 weeks to travel to the final battle station or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 3 weeks, is that it?
3 months.
3 months.
Yeah.
But in the real world, years pass. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
No. Because that's still within the solar system.
Okay.
Command school is on an asteroid.
Okay.
Right.
But when he goes to a colony,
yeah,
that's like a 2 week trip for him, but, you know, 50 years have gone by on Earth.
Okay.
Right. Now, but the reason Ender can't go back to Earth is because his sociopathic brother has, you know, taken over the government, basically. Mm-hmm. And if he goes back to Earth, he'll know, like, he and Valentine both know that, yeah, Peter managed to devise these things so that the entire planet didn't go to war with itself. Mm-hmm. But he was doing it purely for the reasons that he wants to control the world. So Valentine left, and she made it to where Ender could never go home, you know, basically being like, hey, he committed genocide. You people don't want him here, do you? Using her persona for that.
Okay.
I thought it was also because, like, but like, he was such a brilliant general that if he went back, right, nations would fight over him.
He was going to be taken by somebody and used.
But the biggest thing is, like, you know, she didn't want him to be used by Peter.
Mm-hmm.
Because Peter would either use him or kill him.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so it was set up to where it's like, yeah, he could basically just, like, never, ever go back to Earth. Mm-hmm. And so they went off to...
You gotta retire your generals.
Exactly.
Yeah. Ender's Game is not a game you want to win, my friend. not a good game.
Doesn't sound like there's any real winners.
But eventually, Ender then writes a book, which is the story of the Hive Queen, which is titled The Hive Queen. And it's basically like
real original.
The bugger's apology for the war and the explanation of their side, which sort of starts its own religion of, like, being a speaker for the dead and, like, telling the story of someone who has died after they've gone so it can be completely honest. And eventually, when Peter Wiggin, as the 77-year-old leader of Earth, figures out that his brother is the one who wrote it, he gets in touch with him via this instantaneous interplanetary communication, mm-hmm. and Ender then writes his story. Yeah. And those two books together become, like, the founding books of this religion of honesty.
It was Valentine's book.
Was it?
Yeah, it was because Valentine wrote The Hegemon, telling the whole story of, like, she wrote this series of books, and the last one, Ender wrote just the short treatise that was the Hive Queen's story, and it was put at the end of one of Valentine's books. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So while my nerds,
I mean, I'll believe you if that's true, but I won't believe you. It's not.
Yeah. So, like, 90% of the stories,
your nerds have to look stuff up. I'm a little disappointed.
I have the book.
Like, so much happens in the last, like, five chapters after the war. Like, just crazy amount. And I mean, I think Orson
really
Scott Card. It's really a huge epilogue. And I think Orson Scott Card knew at that point he was going to be writing a sequel. I think he did.
Well, apparently, I mean, like, this was originally a short story. And then apparently when he turned this into a novel, it was really, it's a great, brilliant, one of the best science fiction novels ever. But from his perspective, he was like, I need to write the background for this main character for this series of books that I want to write.
And, so he already had the series.
Yeah, so he wanted to, like, create this character who would have this, you know, genocide on his conscience and, you know, how to atone for that and how does this person relate to people then.
So, we're nearing the hour mark, so I gotta start reining things in a little bit.
No,
Sean, you look like you've got.
I wanted to go. It's something we kind of went over and didn't really go into. I think he does a great job of explaining, and that's why you kind of understand the hive mind a little bit better. Mm-hmm. He does a great job of explaining that they really can't even conceive of humans because they are individuals, and they do not understand the concept of individuality because they're all, they're just one being.
They're Borg.
They're Borg. They've just got different appendages, basically. And so that's why they've started wiping out humans. They don't even realize that they're doing anything to, you know, they can't understand a sentient being. And so I think that's what, I do think that's the other twist that you were talking about, is that they're, you know, they're these huge monsters, mm-hmm. and it just really does a good job of switching it, like, within a few paragraphs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry.
It's okay, we've been, like, reference material. So yes, talks about, Valentine wrote all of the books.
Valentine writes Ender's story.
Well, she writes The Hegemon. She writes the story of the history of everything that she and Peter did. And then the last book, it was a 7-book series. And then the last one she wrote was how many volumes till you're through? Just one, the story of Ender Wiggin. You know, I'll write it up to, you know, I'll write it when I brought it up to the present day, and then I'll stop. Then he goes and finds the queen. And then he writes The Hive Queen.
I'm not going to argue with you.
So a couple of, is there anything that you guys want to touch on that we haven't touched on so far? that we can do pretty quickly.
Well, just one really brief thing that's sure. One of the reasons why I love the book so much is that it's formatted wonderfully. Because you do have multiple stories going on, and a lot of books, I think, fall into the trap of we're going to spend a lot of time looking at this one thing as it develops slowly mm-hmm. and gets a little bogged down. But what Orson Scott Card did with this is wonderful because he's like, hey, here's Ender going off to school, and he's there for a couple of years before we go back to the family
yeah.
at all. And then we have... Valentine and Peter hedging their plot to, you know, take over the world. And then we go back to Ender in battle school, you know, spend a couple years there before we come back to Earth again. And by the time we come back to Earth, Peter and Valentine have everything like really well established and everything with their plot is moving along. So that way it's sort of, you know, it gives you wonderful grasp of time frame for these things to develop without you having to sit there and trudge through all of it.
It's paced really yeah. well. Yeah, I mean, I feel like the book really never drags at any given point. It's just like Ender's dealing with this scenario, then he's dealing with this scenario, then we're going to cut back to Earth as they're dealing with this scenario. Like, it's just right. dealing with, like, problem after problem that he has to...
And it's logical with. Jumps. There's, yeah. like, there's connections which are like, and now this is why we're going to go talk about this. It's not, like, this sudden shift at any yeah. point. And I think that kind of formatting is one of the reasons why... you can recommend this book to anybody. It's one of the reasons why the book absolutely holds up.
Yeah, and I love the way he writes logic itself. Like, the characters are so brilliant, and he maps out how they make choices sometimes, and mm-hmm. how, especially in the Bean series, like, how Bean figures things out or how Ender figures things out. And he writes these things that sound very logical and very brilliant, mm-hmm. and you totally buy it. And even when they do make a mistake, you can see where that... like that slight bit of misinformation
yeah.
changes their logic, and that's one thing I like about that book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Pete, any thoughts or something that we haven't touched on that you really want to chomp at the bit at?
The enemy's gate is down.
Yeah. Yes.
Yep.
Yep. Oh, I don't know. What is that? Is that from the game?
What is that?
It's from everything.
That's the fundamental way that Ender rethinks every situation he comes to.
Because he's put into the battle
room.
Read
it again. Read it again. The enemy's gate is down.
Yeah. All right.
It's get it
null
on the
gravity.
T-shirt.
It's the whole null gravity thing.
Okay. Oh, I think I remember this. When he's in the laser tag arena.
Right.
Is that where it is?
But it fixes everything.
You.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything.
That's perspective.
Your bases are belong to us.
Yeah. So, a few quick questions to take us out. Pat, do you have any questions so far?
No.
I'm really sad that we had to spoil it for you.
That's all right. I mean, it wasn't...
Are you
going to
read it?
Yeah, I'll probably... at some point. I may or not read it before the movie, though.
Right.
So.
How do you guys feel about Orson Scott Card as a writer in general? Like,
he's an entertaining writer.
Okay.
I read a bunch of his stuff before I realized he was a Mormon, and then I...
Oh, no, I forgot. Never mind.
Then all of his books are so clearly about, like, these large families who have been oppressed by the government
totally.
And have to, like, go out somewhere else to find their, like, ultimate
city. What does
that
have to do with Mormons?
but they specifically talk about that in Ender's Game. They're like, hey, your families had religion, and then they basically gave it up because we made them, but they didn't really give it up, so you can't really talk to
I'm
them anymore.
Totally going to drink whiskey while reading this book.
I got whiskey.
Yeah.
We can sit
yeah,
together. It, we'll
get. There's like all of his books have these weird undertones. And like,
yeah.
okay.
Everybody should have 12 children.
Yeah, and it's like I read all the Bean and Ender stuff, and then I read Earthbound and some of the Alvin.
Yeah,
the one that you were talking
Apprentice
about.
Alvin.
Yeah,
there, yeah.
And it's pretty cool. Like, I think he writes children well. I think he has this weird. Insight into this childlike mentality, I think, sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's why, for me, Ender's Game works so well, is because it's all these children. He doesn't write love stories very well, I don't think.
No.
There's love stories in a few of them.
He's
it's
a
always
nerd
just like,
who has trouble dating, but...
we're in love now. I was like,
we're in love.
We just sort of knew.
Yeah.
It was...
yeah.
Well, in the sequel, Ender's 35, so how do you like Ender as an older chap?
Good. I like the rest of the Ender story. It's very different. It's
super
it's
different.
So like, yeah. But I still like the character. He's still really interesting.
So you guys have any final thoughts or things about the Ender's Game specifically? Are you excited for the movie?
Remember,
he said that it's an unfilmable book.
Yeah.
I'm concerned about it because it's such a philosophical book, and it's. it's about people wrestling with like moral decisions and loneliness, and I think that doesn't make good movies, and I don't think they're going to make that kind of movie.
I think maybe it's going to be an okay movie if you look at it simply as here's another let's go fight the space bugs kind of movie. I don't think it's going to be a good movie if you think about it in relation to the novel.
Yeah, I feel like the main stars are the adults, which makes sense, of course. But the book's not about the adults at all.
It's not.
Right. Like, I mean, the adults are minor supporting characters. Yeah.
Well, supposedly, like, the brother and sister are completely out of the movie. Like, they're mentioned, but they're
absolutely doesn't work because they're, like, the emotional core that makes makes Ender everything that he is.
I'm just worried that it's going to be a Star Wars episode one.
They're cast and they're pretty highly rated.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Oh, I had heard that the movie does not focus on them very much at all. I mean, they may be in the movie, but they're very substantial to the book.
Yeah. So, it's gonna be one of those things. I'm gonna watch this movie
because I'm gonna pay matinee for it. I will not pay full price.
Yeah. Oh, I'll just torrent it.
Now that we can.
You just got the government shutting this podcast down.
So now I will read the reviews of Ender's Game.
The book or the movie?
The book of the movie.
The book of the movie.
The novel's plot summary reads like a grade Z made-for-television science fiction rip-off movie, but then they say that Card develops the elements well despite this unpromising material. Specifically about Ender, Ender gets to strike out at his enemies and still remain morally clean. Nothing is his fault. He is alternately likable and insufferable. He is a convincing little Napoleon in short pants. I don't remember the short pants part. I feel that he's like, it may not be his fault, but he feels with the like he feels guilt about what he's done. Like he's not without.
Right. Yeah. That's why this so often they have to hide the consequences from him.
So I got some bad news about the movie. The director is the same director that did X-Men Origins Wolverine, the first one. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
But there was the opening one where he was like, helicopter. It's going to be awesome.
So, Pat, hopefully you'll read this sometime. It's very good.
I might read it in the theater.
I mean, you could also watch The Last Starfighter.
Is there a comic book version that I could flip through real fast?
Of Ender's Game? Yeah.
Yeah, there
actually,
is.
Actually, there is.
Or you could watch The Last Starfighter.
Yeah, right?
It hits some of the same beats.
It's just a parallel.
It's a parallel. Actually, when did that come out?
1985 or 86? Yeah.
Okay. All right. I really like this book. Hopefully you'll give it a read and you listeners out there will give it a chance. It's very short. It's not a Game of Thrones. So yeah.
So you don't have to play to win.
So you don't have to play to win. You guys have any final thoughts?
This is our third final thoughts.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. I'm just, all right, fine. We're done. We are done. Do you guys need to plug anything else? Anything that may not be time sensitive that people can, I don't know.
I just wrapped up shooting on an independent horror movie called When the Lights Go Out. So go see that or find it on the internet somewhere if it exists yet, hopefully.
Untime sensitive, maybe. I am going to be stepping in starting in November to be the co-host for the News Tech podcast.
Oh, nice.
And you'll be able to listen to that at discreetfx.com/newstech, NEWSTEK.
This should be up before November, so
yeah, we'll see. Yeah, the first thing we're going to be talking about is portable video editing systems. So.
Ooh. Nerds! Yes. Humans forever!
I'm starting to shoot a pilot with somebody else at this table.
Tell us about this pilot.
I shall, Chris. Thank you. It's called F-Men. It's a kind of a steampunk, low-power superheroes pilot.
High-power comedy.
High-power comedy.
There we go.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah, we're shooting that.
That's
so
the tagline right
hopefully
there.
That'll be up maybe in November or December. We shall see.
Yeah.
I don't know. Pat, do you have anything you wish to plug?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. If you have any comments, questions, or protests, or ideas for topics, please email them at thenerdoutcastpodcast@gmail.com. I have been your host, Chris Bashan, and my guests today have been...
Sean Okerberg.
Kitten McCreary.
Pete Navis.
Patrick Sweetman.
Thank you, and thank you for listening.